people, I think, probably assumed that because we were so feminist and because we were an all-women's band, that most of the people who came to see us were women. But that wasn't true. Usually the balance in the audience would be maybe 60% women, 40% men. You know, they were just having a good time dancing to the music. And I looked out there and thought, this is like a microcosm of the kind of world that I want to live in. So Sweet Sweet Music was mostly just written about experiences like that, that the music could bring you together.
This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Music Heritage, and that Sweet Sweet Music comes from 1975 and the band Deadly Nightshade. They formed in the early 1970s and were among the very first all-female bands signed to a major record label. They were the first of those bands whose music came from a feminist perspective. The members were Pam Brandt, Helen Hook, and Ann Bowen, and I'm pleased to share with you an interview with Pam. And we'll hear all about it. They had two LPs in 1975 and 1976, and have just released a new CD. So I use that as a start for my questions.
To your knowledge, has there ever been another band that went 36 years between albums?
Well, let me think. No.
I could not come up with any. That's not something you can Google. But nothing logical came to my mind either.
Well, it's sort of hard to explain that in our first incarnation, the Deadly Nightshade got together kind of accidentally. And in the second incarnation, we sort of got together accidentally also. And a lot of it was, we don't even know when the first incarnation broke up. We more sort of just fell apart gradually over a period of a year or two.
Well, I want to kind of keep this history kind of chronological. So let's go back to the beginning, which I think was around 1968, and you were all college students and you formed Ariel. Tell me about how that band formed and what was the music like?
Well, Ariel formed from the remnants of an earlier band called the Moppets. The Moppets were formed in, let me think, it must have been 1964 by a woman named Beverly Rogers, who at the time was a junior at Mount Holyoke College. The Moppets were all Mount Holyoke students, so it was an all-women's band. And I got in it about a year and a half after that band formed. So we played various places around the country. We were signed to the William Morris Agency, big agency in New York, and they got us some bookings. We played rock music, none of it political at all, Wooly Bully or whatever, and then later we moved into doing some more ambitious rock music and doing dramatic arrangements and stuff like that. We got more pretentious, let's say. So that band eventually fell apart. At our very last gig at a place called Otto's Grotto in Cleveland, this guy, Bob Baldori, who was then playing keyboard in a band called The Woolies, which had one big hit, Who Do You Love? They were on ABC Dunhill. He came and heard us, and as a result, we got a contract with ABC Dunhill. And, you know, the Moppets just went and fell apart after making that record.
The Moppets released 145 in 1966, and it was a way slowed down cover of a hit the Bo Brummels had called Just a Little. And the Moppets version went like this. I went from the Moppets doing a Bo Brummels song to one I think a lot more amazing. Now, that band did mostly cover songs, and remember that it was not a lesbian band, and Pam was not singing lead. So for them to do the Young Rascals song, Ain't Gonna Eat Out My Heart Anymore, with a female lead singing those female-to-female pronouns, at a live show in Cleveland in 1966, well, that must have turned a few heads. So let's get back to Pam and pick up the story after the breakup of the Moppets, and at the start of the new band, Ariel. she picked up the torch along with another Moppets band member, Gretchen Pfeiffer.
Gretchen and I started putting together another all-female band almost immediately because we had dropped out of school for a year to play with the Moppets, but our parents made us promise we'd go back. So we were both going back to Mount Holyoke, and so we started looking around for other women and found Helen Hook, who is in Deadly Nightshade, and we also found Anne Bowen, the third Deadly Nightshade person, to be in Ariel, which was an even more pretentious band than the Moppets, by far. By far. You know, we took ourselves entirely too seriously, and we did really over-complex, ponderous arrangements of everything. I mean, we wrote songs that sort of made very little sense and were in odd time signatures, and the cover songs we did were only very inaccessible ones. And Ariel went on playing what we called symphonic rock and did it for a couple of years and got pretty close to record contracts a number of times. There were a number of record companies interested initially, but, you know, it would always come down to we'd show up at their offices and they would say, let's see, one time we were at Apple America and some producer stuck his head in the door and said to our A&R person, hey, Eddie, don't sign an all-girl band. You'll only have to pay for their abortions. And then Columbia Records was a little bit interested, but they ended up telling us, no, because we already have an all-girl band.
And you couldn't have more than one.
Exactly. I mean, there were all these all-boy bands, you know, that they were signed, but they considered them just bands. And all-girl bands was a novelty act. Like, you remember that record of the singing dogs? Mm-hmm. They would bark jingle bells. Well, you know, all-girl bands were like that, and really, you only wanted one singing dogs and one all-girl band. So eventually, Ariel broke up, and then the Deadly Nightshade came together accidentally.
Before we leave Ariel, Pam sent me some music by them, and I doubt they have ever been played on the radio. So I'm happy to share with you a little bit of the Buffalo Springfield song, Rock and Roll Woman. This is from a live show at Thompson's Tavern in Waverly, New York, in March of 1970.
The Deadly Nightshade came together accidentally.
Was there a time lag in between those two?
There certainly was. Yeah, there was a time lag of about, I think it was a couple of years. And during that time, all three of us had moved back to the New England area to base ourselves and ended up living on the same farm in a sort of informally communal household like they had a lot of in those days. And the three of us were doing odd jobs to support ourselves, among which the most successful was we were garbage collectors. We would get in a truck and go around to construction sites and clean up after the, you know, the, after the builders and the contractors, and take it to the dump. We called ourselves the Wrecked Wrecking Company because we, you know, partook of substances while, you know, and we smoked quite a bit while we were doing our work. And what resulted was work that was very slow but very thorough. And the thoroughness made us very popular as a garbage collecting company. Meanwhile, we were not playing music then, but Anne was working at the Valley Women's Center. Northampton, because Smith and Mount Holyoke and all of that, was sort of a little pocket of very active early feminism. And the Valley Women's Center was wonderful. So they were having a conference, putting together a women's conference, and we played there. And from there, other people heard us and kept offering us jobs. And we thought, sure beats collecting garbage. So we just stayed together, and that was how Deadly Nightshade started.
Well, I have to ask how the name of the band was picked.
The Deadly Nightshade was actually a name we thought of back in Ariel when, you know, Ariel had real business cards like all businesses do. But a lot of the guys who would come up to us and ask for a business card were just pests who were trying to hit on us. So we would make fake business cards. We would take big pieces of pasta. I don't know what kind of pasta you call it. It's a big rectangular piece of pasta that's about the size of a business card. And we would write down fake band names and fake phone numbers and everything like that on these business cards. And to these pest guys, we would just give one of these fake business cards. And one of the fake band names we thought of at the time was the Deadly Nightshade. And we just thought it was funny.
These were cards made of pasta?
Yes. Well, we didn't want to pay for to get cards actually printed up when they were fake cards.
Right.
So, you know, we thought of all sorts of different names, and the Deadly Nightshade stuck, and we decided to use that name and didn't even realize at the time that there could be feminist interpretations to it and stuff like that.
So you attracted enough attention by now that you were signed by RCA.
We decided to come down to New York and try playing a club there because we thought we might like to do some recording. And called up our old Ariel's old manager, Ron Shelley, invited him to come down and see that we actually had become a band that people liked. and he was impressed. I mean, there were lines outside the door of people wanting to get in because, you know, we were building up a reputation as a really fun band. And eventually, Lucy Simon came and heard us when we were at Max's Kansas City. Lucy urged, some people from RCA to come down, and actually she dragged them down, and they liked us, and we were signed to Phantom, which is a custom label of RCA.
Did RCA know how to promote the band?
Oh, no.
That was kind of a leading question.
No, well, we gave them a few hints. For example, in our recording contract, we insisted on a clause where we had a lot of control over our advertising. We said they were not allowed to publicize us in any way that would be offensive to feminist sensibilities. And we actually used that clause because they had no idea what was offensive to feminist sensibilities. They took a big ad in Rolling Stone, full-page ad, that was just rip-roaring wrong. I think one line was, male chauvinist pigs will not be offended, which is absurd. I mean, of course they're going to be offended. And so we made RCA buy another full-page ad, and what we did was we ran the same ad over again, but we scratched out everything that was offensive in the ad and scribbled in, handwritten, our own corrections. The obvious one being changing male chauvinist pigs will not be offended. We just crossed out the not. So, yes, male chauvinist pigs will be offended. So they pretty much were getting the idea of how to promote us in that sense. But they always kind of had this idea that what we would be is a hit pop band, and they kind of wanted to ignore that we basically had an alternative music audience. And we also had a large country music audience. They wanted us to be just pop. So when the second album came out, they didn't want us to do any country songs because they didn't want us to be seen as a country band. Regular was a word they used a lot. The Deadly Nightshade, in each album, about half the songs were outright feminist songs. So, you know, it was a mix of feminist songs, outright feminist songs, and what they called regular songs. And they kept saying to us, why don't you just stick to the regular songs? You know, okay, a band like the Rolling Stones can go out and write a song that is just vile about women, a real, you know, sexist song, and that was not considered a political statement. But if we wrote a song that was anti-sexist, that was considered a political statement. So, again, those were the times.
This is a great time to hear about one of those songs that was very anti-sexist, and it's one of their best known and most anthemic ones, called High Flying Woman.
Well, it's really just sort of a feminist anthem, only it doesn't sound like an anthem. It sounds like, when we play it live, it sort of sounds like a country rock song. And the way it is on the first album, they made it into sort of more of a little pop song. Words were very important to feminists back in those days. Well, like the word chick, you were all supposed to be a woman, not a girl if you were over a certain age, because the way the words had been used in those days for men and women, even when you were 80, men would say, hi, girls, but they were men, you know. It was girls and men. It wasn't girls and boys. And then chick was one of those words also, which we really hated because, you know, as band people, it was okay for women to be in bands if they were just the chick singer for a male band. You know, what was considered inappropriate was for women to actually be the band, be the players. So the whole chick thing really rubbed us wrong. So that's what the whole song originally started out as, just sort of a thing about, you're not a chick, you're a free-flying woman, a high-flying woman. And it sort of got more general as the song went on about how women should not be in a cage, you should set yourself free, take yourself for a glide, you're a high-flying woman.
That you lived in a cage? Did you ever think that you lived in a cage? Well, they're calling you a chick, and the name just seems to stick, and you still don't think you're living in a cage. Have you heard of
How were the two RCA albums received? And I'm talking critically and with respect to sales.
They were critically received very well. And sales-wise, they were very disappointing to RCA. I think we sold somewhere around 30,000 of each, which, I mean, we would be very happy to sell 30,000 of our new CD. And even if we had sold 250,000 records, I think they would not have been happy.
How feminist and how political would you say the band was in the 70s?
We were never, ever non-political, definitely. I mean, at least half of the songs on each of our albums, I think anyone would describe as outright feminist. You know, they were about certain situations, like a former secretary with a sexist boss turning the tables on him. That was Dance, Mr. Big Dance. And there was High Flying Woman, which was, you know, just a typical feminist support song. I think we were really in the middle between, you know, bands who were all women's bands who were definitely not political explicitly, and bands who existed for the purpose of politics, which would be like the New Haven Band and the Chicago Band. Those were bands that were formed by political activists, and they were formed really for the purpose of singing about political issues, feminist issues, and bringing people to be aware of them through music, through the songs that they wrote. Those bands were formed by political activists. They were not musicians. You know, that wasn't their primary purpose in forming the band. Deadly Nightshade, we were all experienced musicians. Our thinking was, there are women's bands out there now. Most of them who are playing are like the Berkeley and Chicago people, or women's music people. They're playing for our own people, mostly. You know, for other feminists, they're playing for audiences of all women. And that is great. But I think someone from the, either the Berkeley or Chicago band said something about wanting to get the message to all women. And you're not going to get the message to all women by just playing political gigs, because an awful lot of women don't go to things like that. So how you get the message to everybody is you play everywhere and you hit them from all sides. So we were thinking, you know, we're accomplished enough musicians that we can get, you know, a major label contract, and we're just hitting them from another side, as, you know, Berkeley or the people who were in the women's music community. To us, it was like we were all part of the same thing.
With much hindsight, and acknowledging that the early 70s were very different times, how closeted would you say the band was?
Too closeted. Closeted enough that I rapidly grew ashamed of it. It was what was done at the time. And as a matter of fact, much later in the mid-1990s, when I was co-writing a book for Simon & Schuster called The Girls Next Door Into the Heart of Lesbian America, and I was traveling the country interviewing, you know, trying to cover different aspects of lesbian culture, I was doing women's music. I spoke to Margie Adam, and she was just laughing at how many women in the women's music community who played to virtually exclusively lesbian feminist audiences were... The musicians were not out themselves. You know, there was even a Chris Williamson interview from a little later that time, maybe in 2000, when she said something like, "I never said I was gay." I never said that.
Okay.
You know, to an interviewer who assumed that she was out, but because, you know, please. You know, and Margie was laughing, you know, with me. We were going like, she was going, "Who did we think we were kidding? And why did we think we should kid them?" You know, I mean, there were real reasons in the mainstream music industry. RCA used to give us enough trouble just about writing outright feminist songs. You know, there was that business I mentioned. Why don't you write regular songs? They sure didn't want us to write gay songs.
Did RCA know that this was essentially a lesbian band?
Oh, they knew. It was sort of one of those things like everyone knew. We just didn't say it. Yeah, they certainly knew, because sometimes they would explicitly throw things in our faces about Laura Nero, or, "Oh, Dusty Springfield, she came out in Rolling Stone as bisexual and it ruined her career." You know, they would say stuff like that to us. It wasn't like we'd even said, hey, we're going to write a gay song or something.
These were warning shots.
Oh, yeah. You've gone far enough. You've gone too far already. Don't go farther. And also, the truth is, even though we played gay bars, all women's events, we played 3 or 4 New York gay pride rallies, so some people would think, like, that was automatically coming out to, you know, an audience of 10,000 people. We played gay benefits for various organizations and political candidates and stuff like that. We were personally not entirely open about our gayness. Helen and I had never discussed it with our families, for instance. And we were a couple for like 9.5 years, which included through the whole Deadly Nightshade. We were out to our friends who knew we were a couple and everything like that, but not our families.
It's interesting, in all the research I did about the band prior to our talking, that little morsel you just talked about, I found that once, mentioned just once.
What, that Helen and I were a couple?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we had never come out and said in an interview that we were a couple. So I guess it had never even come up in an interview. This was, you know, back in the days when everybody was being sort of like overly considerate of each other and protective about not outing people. Almost sort of, the gay community was almost like encouraging artists not to talk about it openly. Because so many of us in all walks of life were in some aspect of those lives in the closet.
Tell me about Someone Down in Nashville.
Someone Down in Nashville, it was a song to explain sort of the appeal of country music to people. Country music is sort of known particularly for dealing with, you know, personal relationships, either positive or more often negative or something like that. It's like, you know, when you don't know what to say to somebody that you're in love with, Someone Down in Nashville has doubtless already said it for you.
Why did the band stop? And I'm talking about the first time.
Pretty much Ann wanted to go have a life is the reason why. Part of the old band's dynamic with Helen and I being a couple and being the main songwriting team, it sometimes seemed like two against one, or at least a couple and then a person on, you know, on the outside when we were on the road or something like that. And Ann had a girlfriend, you know, she wanted to see more of that girlfriend and live with the girlfriend and, you know, that kind of thing. She wanted to have a personal life. And the Deadly Nightshade is not one of those bands like, you know, the Rolling Stones or Isis, which went through many personnel changes. But with the Deadly Nightshade, we were always three very distinct personalities working together. That was our whole charm. That was a major part of our whole appeal to two people. So one person couldn't just drop out, even though she was not, you know, the main songwriting team. She was essential. Anna was always essential to the band, as essential as Helen or me. And we could not have a Deadly Nightshade with anybody else in it except the three of us.
Tell me about the band's connection to Sesame Street.
Someone from Sesame Street came to see the band when we were playing in New York. And at the time, they were much more freewheeling. Sesame Street wasn't that old a show. And so they got to creatively be a little more off the wall. They didn't have so many rules about an educational developmental guidelines and what you couldn't do and everything. So they were just seeing us as a good time band and thinking they'd be great on this show. So they asked us to come on, and we did Keep on the Sunny Side, which is the song we almost always open with and still do. An old song that the most famous version was recorded by the Carter family, only we do it about 500 times faster than the Carter family. And there actually is still a YouTube video of us on Sesame Street playing that song at speeds that some YouTube viewers have commented seem like we were on some kind of drug, you know, some really speedy drug. But it wasn't. It was all just us.
There's a dark and a troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side too. Though we meet with the darkness and strife, the sunny side we also may view. Crushing hopes that we cherished so dear. Clouds and storms will in time pass away. The sun again will shine bright and clear. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help you every day if we're riding all the way. If you keep on the sunny side of life.
On to the second album, which was the next year, called Funky and Western. And the big hit was Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman. And I'm wondering, did it seem kind of disconcerting that that song, which is like no other song you released, was the only one to make it to the charts?
Well, no. We didn't really expect our songs to make the, top 100 charts. Mary Hartman was sort of like the obvious hit because disco was very big back then. And we basically didn't play any disco, and which is why the song sort of started as a joke. Some people think that it was RCA imposing a disco style on us, but that much was not true. The idea came from us, and it happened sort of small. We were playing on a radio station in Boston. They were televising a live concert. We were doing at Passim. We used to play there a lot. So we were doing this live broadcast, and Ann Brooks String. Which meant we couldn't continue playing until she changed the string. So I was just trying to fill time by telling people about what our next projects were going to be. And I don't know, maybe we didn't have any next projects, so I was just making them up. Mary Hartman had a huge cult following at the time. So I said, do you remember the theme song from Mary Hartman? It was very slow and sappy. It was like, na 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 na, you know, like that. So I said that the next thing we were going to do as soon as we got back to New York was to write and record a disco version of the theme from Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, which, you know, was ridiculous because we were, you know, disco was one musical genre we definitely did not play in any shape or form. We got back to New York and went into, you know, Monday morning, went back into our record company president's office, and it was like, har, har, har. Listen to what we said on the radio, and he said, that's a good idea. Why don't you do it? So we quickly wrote an arrangement. We recorded it. And we stayed up for 48 hours straight just to get it in early because it seemed like, you know, it was an idea that somebody who was serious about doing it would probably have, you know, immediately, if not sooner. And sure enough, we turned it into RCA, and they had already that week gotten, I think, 8 or 11 or something other disco versions of the theme from Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman. But RCA ended up picking ours to release over the others.
And here's the song, which made it nationally on the Billboard charts to number 79.
Understand you were honored by the Smithsonian Institute. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, sort of near the end of Deadly Nightshade, someone from the Smithsonian who had been at a number of our jobs for women's organizations, like NOW conferences and stuff like that, asked us to contribute, what did she call them? Artifacts. Yes, Deadly Nightshade artifacts.
Oh, are we that old?
Yeah. To the Smithsonian. At the time, the Smithsonian didn't have any other women's bands in the whole museum. That meant a lot to us because it was really important to have the Smithsonian recognize that feminist musicians were also politicians, not just Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Gloria Steinem, all of those other people.
Talk about Ain't I a Woman.
It's a song that we wrote from a famous speech of Sojourner Truth, who had been a slave and was an early first wave suffragette. She had a very famous speech, I think it was at the Seneca Falls conference, where she basically said, I've spent my life working as hard as a man and, and ain't I a woman? And she just kept repeating different experiences in her life as a slave woman. And I really adore the song.
I've read about the band backing up Flo Ballard, and I'd really love to hear you talk about that.
That could have been the greatest single gig we ever had. What happened was, in Detroit, which is the home of the Supremes, of course, some women's organizations were having a benefit for Joanne Little. They were having Gloria Steinem, Lily Tomlin. They were having us. And they had talked Flo Ballard into coming in and singing. Flo Ballard, at that time, she was an original Supreme. The powers to be at Motown had thrown Flo Ballard out of the group. And it was a really traumatic experience for her. And she hadn't sung since that, which had been years and years and years before. So it was a big deal that they had talked Flo into essentially having this benefit be her first comeback gig. They asked us if we could possibly back her up. Did we know any Supremes? And we were like, do we know any Supremes? Because we had their picture of the original Supremes on our practice room wall to give us inspiration. We adored the Supremes. Well, when we got there, it turned out that Flo refused. She did not want to play any Supremes whatsoever. She was anti-Supreme. It was still like a raw wound on her, the whole idea. And she was living in poverty at the time, but she didn't want to do Supremes. And there was only one song she wanted to do, which was that Helen Reddy song, I Am Woman. So the evening came and she went on, she sang I Am Woman. It was her crowd, you know, that most of the people in the audience hadn't come for Gloria or Lily or for us. They had come to see Flo making her comeback. So the crowd really applauded her and it was a really warm reception. And she walked off the stage and they were yelling encore, encore, encore. And so she got off the stage, but she was all kind of like wide-eyed and not knowing what to do. And so I took her hand and said, you have to do more. You know, they really want you. And started pulling her off the stage. And as soon as she got in within sight lines of the audience, she shrugged my hand off. And I was like, okay, and went back to stand with the rest of the Deadlies. And she just strolled very slowly and imperiously and diva-like across the front of the stage. And as she was passing the Deadlies, she just sort of swung her head back across her shoulder and said to us, by any chance, would you happen to know? Come see about me. So, of course we did. And so we played Come See About Me, and we also played Back in My Arms Again, you know, in back of her. And then the crowd absolutely went wild, because of course what they wanted was Flo singing old Supremes. So boy, that was an amazing musical experience.
Tell us about the process of the band getting back together and the decision to record a new CD.
Well, I think I got into before that the Deadly Nightshade has always been a band that needed all three of us. And so it wasn't a band, you know, after Anne dropped out. You know, with the three of us together, there was a sort of magic that happened. Practically speaking, it just came out of a reunion of Ariel that was just done at Helen's summer house that she has. And it was just a private party where Ariel got together, but without Anne Bowen. And Helen and I realized that it was really fun seeing Gretchen and Beverly, but musically what we wanted to do was get back together and play with Deadly Nightshade. So a year later or 2 years later, that's exactly what we did. Helen booked a couple of gigs, and we got back together to see what it would be like, and it was wonderful. I mean, the very first day, we all remembered our parts and we were playing together just the same as usual, even after, 35 years or whatever. So we like it. So we wanted more of it.
So talk about the new CD.
Well, we can't play live very much, unfortunately, because we live in different parts of the country and work. We have jobs where we live. But we did want to play more, and you know, we wanted to write some more new songs and arrange some more new songs. and have a recording experience that was different from the first two albums, in that it really would be us playing on the record and not a lot of C Studio musicians, and that it would sound like us and we could play those songs live. And it sort of gave us an opportunity to write and record all of those songs that actually had been developing in our minds ever since the first incarnation of Deadly Nightshade fell apart. So we decided we wanted to do it. I would like people to know exactly what is on the new Deadly Nightshade CD. It's a mix, like in the old days, of silly songs and serious songs, and of songs that are political and songs that are, you know, not explicitly political. And then there are, what is it, five songs that are audio and video from the old days of the Deadly Nightshade.
Well, we haven't heard any of the new music yet, so I want to start with a bit of the song, She.
The She, it's about leadership more than about any particular She. I mean, the She is not your girlfriend or your mother. It's really about sort of leadership from a feminist perspective and from the perspective of a feminine or female principle, what people think of as feminine or female values. You're thinking of leadership in a new way that is not based on what are commonly thought of as masculine traits. And then there's a rap section in the middle where we kind of go through actual female leaders and everything. That's a good song. I like it.
Magazine and Billie Jean K, and not just here in the USA. It's women and girls all over the world. They show us a way to be all we can be, a power for peace, love, and equality. She. Coretta Scott King worked all her days for civil rights and women and gays. When a man said stop, she reminded them, sons, that rights are for all or else are for none. From the White House to houses all over the place, who gave you the life, who makes the space safe? She. Dorley Rainey, she's 85, she went to Occupy and got maced in the eyes, and she said, I feel so energized. Here's a clue for the boys in blue in Seattle. Weapons won't win when the old lady battles. Who's got the mouth, the wisdom, the guts to get beat down and get right back up? She.
There's a song called the John Deere Song that is a true story about encountering a naked woman riding a John Deere tractor. It was a perfect stranger who, bought tickets to, the Deadly Nightshade concert and then came the wrong night. And we felt bad because she had gotten a babysitter and everything, you know, and babysitters are hard to come by. So we decided we'd go up, sing a few songs for her and sort of make it up to her a little bit. She owned this bed and breakfast that was out in the country. When we got there, the three of us, she was nowhere to be found. Nobody was at home, it seemed. And then we heard this vroom, 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 and a tractor came over the hill, over the grounds. The grounds were extensive, acres and acres. And it was a huge tractor, not just one of those ride-on lawnmowers. And as it got closer to us, we saw that riding on top of the tractor was this woman, and she was stark naked, which was kind of stunning. Sure surprised the hell out of us. So she got next to us and leaned down and said, with this big grin on her face, there's nothing like riding naked on a John Deere tractor.
Mm-hmm.
Another part of the CD I want to mention is the video part.
Oh, yeah. Well, in the old days, the Deadly Nightshade was kind of not famous, but semi-famous or almost famous. But, you know, we realized from when we first got together that many of our old fans probably wouldn't remember us. And probably there would have been people even our age who were feminists who had never heard of us because, you know, we weren't that famous back then. Then there were people who, you know, we'd like to reach who weren't even born when we were originally together. So we wanted to put the revived Deadly Nightshade in the context of the old Deadly Nightshade to give people an idea of the band's whole journey. So we wanted to include some old stuff, which is we played in 86, I think?
84.
84, at the 10th anniversary of the National Women's Music Festival in the Midwest. And a woman there had videotaped us with the clunky equipment of the day. But the gig actually sounds, very good. It has some songs from the old days and actually shows us so that you don't just get the musical part of things like Dance Mr. Big, but you can see Anne playing the dancing doll and so on.
I was surprised how good the audio quality is on that recording.
Well, we were too. The audio quality sounded pretty good and the band sounded pretty good. You know, it's enjoyable and it puts the new or revived Deadly Nightshade in the context of the old Deadly Nightshade.
I know the history of Deadly Nightshade is not over, but what do you consider your place in music history?
Well, we were not the first all-female band, which some people seem to think we were. But the Deadly Nightshade was the only all-female band signed to a mainstream major record label that recorded songs with explicit outright feminist content, subject matter. And so I think that was important. And we were one of the first female bands. So I think that how accomplished we were musically is also a contribution because in some of the, you know, really first female bands, there wasn't a high level of musicality. It was really more like you were getting to play jobs because you were a novelty group. I think what this new album shows, which was also on the old album, is that you can stand for something and not have all your songs be explicitly about it. I mean, the Deadly Nightshade always did a mix of serious songs with messages and silly songs. The only way that the silly songs could be considered political is that we deliberately never wrote offensive songs, songs that were offensive to, you know, to minority groups anyway. We did write deliberately songs that were offensive to homophobes and sexist pigs and stuff like that, and we'll continue to do that forever. But for us back in the day, it was considered inappropriate for young women like us, like we were then, to play in loud electric bands. Now, many more young women are playing in bands, thank heaven, but it's still considered inappropriate for old ladies to play in loud electric bands. So that's really sort of like another reason we got back together, we thought. Seems like it's time for us to have some more fun. And, you know, back then we behaved inappropriately. Now we're behaving inappropriately for different reasons. And I hope that we continue just sort of breaking down doors for the rest of our lives.
I want to add to Pam's answer about being one of the first female bands signed to a major label. The two main others who fit that were Fanny, signed to Reprise, and Isis, who recorded on Buddha and United Artists. They had lesbian members but were not all lesbian bands, though I grant that to the public, the Deadly Nightshade were not openly lesbian, a sign of those times. This is J.D. Doyle thanking you for listening and Pam Brandt for the wonderful interview. You can find more info on the Deadly Nightshade at www.thedeadlynightshade.net and get their new CD at cdbaby.com. And you know, I've got more of my interview with Pam on my site, queermusicheritage.com. And in part two, I ask her about another groundbreaking band she was in called Lowlife in the early 1980s. That included one of my gay music heroes, Michael Callan. They were a mixed gay and lesbian band, which it turned out was quite ahead of its time. Anyway, of course I saved a special Deadly Nightshade song to close this show. I asked Pam to tell me about a new one called Don't the Lovers Ever Win.
Right, that's actually the first song with outright gay subject matter that the Deadly Nightshade ever wrote or performed or recorded. It's a song about gay rights and the people who want to foil those, the oppressors and the homophobes. The original Deadly Nightshade should have been writing about some gay subject matter, I feel, in retrospect. And then there were, 35 years since we broke up. So when you go to tackle a gay rights song and a song about homophobes, there's been a lot of homophobia and a lot of gay rights issues, in the last 35 years. So basically you have the tendency to say, okay, now I'm going to write about every single gay rights issue that ever occurred. If it's your first song, you just want to say it all at once, say everything that you should have said for years before that. But couldn't do that. So basically I just decided to tackle the gay rights issues and the homophobes that were not only oppressive, but were totally stupid. Couldn't be stupider. Stupid with a double O stupid, S-T-O-O-P-I-D, that's stupid. So the song was supposed to be gently ironic, Don't the Lovers Ever Win. It points out these things that people are trying to do to us who are haters and just asks the question, don't the lovers ever win?
They're telling